Hello, I'm Terrence McNally. Welcome to the 8th newly recorded episode of A World That Just Might Work in 2017. I'll be joined today by music biz veteran and author Danny Goldberg. I just want to say at the start here that after hosting and producing the show weekly for 17 years, I stepped away from recording new live interviews. And since then, I've dug into the archives to stream one of the best of my earlier interviews, something relevant to the week, each week on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. And podcasts of years of interviews are available to listen to anytime, anywhere on iTunes and at my site, terrencemcnally.net or worldthatjustmightwork.com. But following the election of Donald Trump, I cannot resist exploring our path forward in confronting him and his administration. And on this show, we've always explored the lives, the work, and the ideas of folks that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work, based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. And today's guest is, as I said, Danny Goldberg. Before I bring him on, let me just mention that I want to always throw out these days some websites where you can learn more to plug into how to resist the administration, and indivisibleguide1word.com, ourrevolution1word.com, couragecampaign.org, moveon.org, and townhallproject.com, and fivecalls.org are all very helpful websites if you want to participate more than you have been. Danny Goldberg, president of Gold Village Entertainment, has worked in the music business as a personal manager, a record company president, public relations man, and a journalist since the late 1960s. He was president of Gold Mountain Entertainment with Nirvana, Bonnie Raitt, the Allman Brothers, CEO of Air America Radio, chairman and CEO of the Mercury Records Group and Warner Brothers Records, president of Atlantic Records, vice president of Led Zeppelin's Swan Song Records. In 1980, he co-produced and co-directed the rock documentary No Nukes. He serves on the books Robert Greenwald's organization that puts out timely films. And by the way, Brave New Films is another place to plug into in these days. And he's also on the board, Danny is, of Public Citizen. He's the author of How the Left Lost Teen Spirit, Bumping into Geniuses, My Life Inside the Rock and Roll Business, and his latest, In Search of the Lost Chord, 1967 and the Hippie Idea. Welcome, Danny Goldberg, to A World That Just Might Work.
Hey, Terrence, how are you?
I'm good. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. So, in your own words, briefly, can you talk about your path to the work that you do today and define that work broadly? Because I see you both as music business, you know, you've done about everything there is to do in that, but you've also been an activist, a behind-the-scenes person, and so on. So tell us your path, and feel free to mention mentors, turning points, moments of decision, that sort of thing.
Oh, goodness. Well, I was a pretty bad student in high school, and was quite into drugs when I was a teenager. So I have basically no college education. I was, you know, went to the University of California for classes for an entire week before dropping out, and got into some trouble out there. I'd grown up in the New York area, came back to New York, and you know, by the end of 1968, I had gotten a job at Billboard magazine, which is trade magazine in the music business, just originally so I could get my own apartment and didn't have to live with my parents at the time. And then discovered quickly there was this thing called the music business, where people who didn't have musical talent could still be part of the process of working with artists and working with music and make a living doing it. And I wanted in because, you know, it was one of the few things I was really passionate about, and it didn't seem to depend on, you know, having done well in 10th grade English class or calculus or any of those things that had bedeviled me. And, you know, over the years, as you said, I started as kind of a ersatz critic. I wasn't that critical. I was more of a fan, and I was much more effective as a PR person, and got, you know, just over somehow 50 years passed almost, and I've been, you know, most of my adult life in different aspects of the music business, primarily working with rock and roll artists, although not only in that genre. And I had always had some political ideas and some spiritual yearnings that emanated from the way I grew up in the 60s. As you mentioned, in 1980, I was able to be involved with a political rock documentary called No Nukes that was based around concerts that were held the year before, organized primarily by John Hall of the group Orleans, Bonnie Raitt, and Jackson Browne, and which are best known for some of the performances Bruce Springsteen gave in them. And that was both really fun for me to spend a year with my friend Julian Schlossberg putting together a documentary, the only time I really did anything like that. And secondly, because it made me realize that there was some role for people in the entertainment business and the political conversation that I'd always been interested in, that I became one of those Hollywood liberals. At that time, I was living in L.A. That's how I got to friendly with Robert Greenwald, who you were just talking about, because he was in that same group of a couple hundred people that were just trying to, you know, express whatever our liberal ideas that we had through using the role that we had in the entertainment world. And that's been a part of my life since then. And, you know, I try to balance these things out. I'm also somebody that's been influenced by the mystical aspects of the 60s. You know, I stopped taking psychedelics after a few years. It was not, but it made a certain permanent effect in terms of intensifying my notion that there's something bigger than us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't preach any particular religion. I'm not a part of any organization, but I do believe that there's, I do identify with the idea of a larger universe. And I've been, somebody who's been very influenced by Ram Dass, you know, and some other spiritual teachers. And I have my own podcast, not quite as successful as yours, but that I've just started doing, called Rock and Rolls on Be Here Now Network. And, you know, so to me, it's just, but a lot of these strands, rock and roll, mysticism, progressive politics, the idea of trying to, you know, do whatever you can in the world, you know, both, you know, while taking care of yourself and the people you love, but also, you know, trying to do a little bit of good. You know, we're very much influenced by my teenage years and the culture that I experienced as a high school student. And that's why I just did this new book, which mm-hmm. is kind of a history of the year 1967, 50 years ago. Not a memoir, because I was just a kid and wasn't doing all that much that was particularly interesting, but I was observing as a kind of fan and consumer of the culture, the anti-war movement, the developing of the civil rights movement, the explosion of the use of psychedelics, the explosion of album rock and roll, and rock and roll kind of really becoming part of the soundtrack of that time. And so I went back and tried to research what actually happened in a very short length of time, and to see the extent to which there are lessons for today from that time.
You entered the music business at a time of enormous change, really. It was the time when albums and FM were both fairly new, and they changed everything. It feels like this period we're in now is similarly a time of enormous change. Can you assess sort of where we are in the, you know, in terms of the music business? Are these good or bad times for artists and for music?
Well, firstly, there are several music businesses, plural, that kind of coexist and affect each other, but they're very different businesses. And two of the most well-known ones are the recording business and the live performance business, which are two completely different businesses, but yet the success of records or recordings can help motivate and create demand for concert tickets, and the success of concerts can build up eventually a fan base for recordings, or at least it used to be that way.
Mm-hmm.
And so the live performance part of the business has not changed, except to the extent that music changes and that the demographics and the economies of different parts of the world change. But the basic business model of live performance is pretty much the same as it's always been, you know, which is people buy tickets, and out of that money, it's divided up between whoever puts on the concert and most of it going to the performers. The recording business has gone through several extremely dramatic revolutions, and you know, in the last 15 years has been a time of decline financially in the record business, you know, pretty dramatically, you know, due to the available of free music, you know, on the web, you know, whether it's through YouTube, whether it's illegal file serving, you know, now there are these legal streaming businesses, but still far less money filters down to the, you know, to the artists. And it's not good for artists in terms of money, because there's just so much less money in recordings.
I spoke recently with Jonathan Taplin.
Yeah.
I'm sure you know Jonathan. You know, he's got the new book, Move Fast and Break
Things.
Which
I strongly recommend to anyone listening.
It's same here.
It's a fantastically interesting book. I share his views about the effect of the internet on intellectual property and on artists and songwriters.
Yeah, I mean, he points out
he's one of the most eloquent people writing about that.
Yeah.
And then, of course, he also brings it into the larger stage of the effect in general on the society of the concentration of power in Google, Facebook, and Apple and Amazon and so forth.
Yeah, and he points out the difference between, you know, people kind of assume there's a difference between what you made with the old record companies and you make with streaming, but he points out the enormous difference between even iTunes and Spotify and YouTube, where almost, I mean, the money nowadays is minuscule in most of those streaming services.
Yeah, it's very low. A lot of these services are still revolve around the notion of free exposure to music as a vehicle to aggregate, you know, people who then you sell money to advertisers to reach, and that's a much smaller amount of money, you know, there, you know, than selling it. And it's just one of those things that I don't delude myself as running a small management company that I can change the course of that.
Yeah.
I have to advise my clients based on the reality of it. And it's of course, this is, you know, the digital world has disrupted many, many, many businesses. Most other than the recording business, I would say newspapers and magazines have been most dramatically affected. But it's just the way it is. So in terms of the revenue from records, the availability of record companies to kind of be the investment bank for artists, to take risks on artists, both in terms of recording costs, giving them money to live, or the marketing, you know, that's a dramatic drop. You know, sales are down less than half of what they used to be, and the financial valuations of the catalogs, which were the big motivator of a lot of the investment, are down 80 or 90%. And there's no evidence that that's going to change in
right.
the foreseeable future. So that's just the way it is. Look, in the 19th century, there were no record companies. There were still music and people making a living being musicians. And the artists in different times have had to find different ways of making a living and supporting themselves and their families, and different ways of reaching the public. So this is a new era, no question about that. The question about the late 60s, you're absolutely right. That was an explosion of growth, because although technologically the ability to record albums, you know, 40 minutes in length or 50 minutes, whatever it was, had existed for a while, it was mainly the province as a creative medium of people in classical music that rock and roll artists and pop artists were really primarily in the business of selling singles, and right. albums were just kind of collections of singles, not coherent works of art. And that did change in the mid-60s, you know, as artists like Bob Dylan, the Beatles, and the Rolling Stones started having creative visions. And then there was this exposure medium that you mentioned, of the growth of FM radio, that started playing albums, so that the artists were not limited just to the so-called top 40
yeah.
pop stations to expose their hits. And those two forces, combined with the gigantic quantity of young people, the so-called baby boom generation, created a huge upsurge in growth of the recording business, starting in the late 60s, and it continued till the end of the 90s, when the digital
yeah.
revolution started to dissipate the value of recordings.
You mentioned it, of course, in the book, but I mean, people kind of know this, that music was significant in terms of the culture, in terms of a lot of what you talk about in this book, or anything in the 60s and 70s. Is music still Given the changes that have happened in terms of how artists make a living, et cetera, et cetera, do you see music still having a lot of influence, or has that waned? Or is it, my guess would be that it has influence in certain areas, but not as much across the board.
Well, I always think it's dangerous for older people to talk about music because really, I don't know how old you are, but I'm going to turn 67 next, you know, in July.
I turn 69 tomorrow. We're
okay. So yeah. You know, the reality is that I think that a lot of people who are in the area of psychology have agreed that the teenage years are the times when music has the greatest effect on people. And there's something about the relationship to adolescence and music, that music just kind of gets into the brain as sort of a identity thing. And I still remember all the lyrics of songs from my teenage years, and I can't really remember necessarily lyrics of songs, new songs, you know, that I heard a month ago.
Yeah.
And I think most people, when they talk about the golden age of music, for them, it's about when they were that age.
Yeah.
And I think young people today, there's a huge, vast worldwide audience that's very engaged in music. It's not music I particularly understand because I'm too old.
Yeah.
My kids understand it a lot better. They're in their 20s. But certainly hip-hop, pop, electronic dance music, these are you look at the gigantic crowds that come to festivals. You look at the hundreds of millions of streams of music for these younger artists like Drake. There's just no question that music is still a language that speaks to a different part of young people than other media does and creates a sense of community that's unique. And I still think it's extremely important, but I don't have the firsthand connection to it I did when I was younger.
Right. I think, I by the way, I take your, you know, your caution sort of on my assumption. That's well taken. I absolutely know what you're saying is that since so much of even what was happening in the 60s is that sense of community and identity, there's no way you or I can know what that feels like today.
But there's no question that these festivals that are a global phenomenon are very meaningful experiences for people. And there's no question that the amount of time people are spending listening to music is as great or greater than it ever was.
So, so something's going on.
It's a big deal culturally. It's a much smaller deal in terms of financially, the recording side of it.
Yeah. So let's slip to another thing that you had a hand in, which was you were the first chair or executive director or whatever it was of Air America. How did that happen?
Well, first of all, I was not the first.
Ah.
I was there was a series of people who were CEO of Air America, and I think I was the second to last. It was started I had known John Sinton, who I believe Air America was his idea.
Yep.
And it was certainly the first place where I heard it, and he somehow found the startup money for it and contacted the original group of talent. And he'd been a friend of mine. He'd been a radio a programming consultant originally in the rock and roll area, a guy that I used to schmooze to get him to play Stevie Nicks records.
Uh-huh.
And then he developed this keen interest in public affairs and politics. And then, the star that was the most successful at that time and that really kind of created Air America's footprint was Al Franken.
Right.
And I had known Franken a bit, and one of my labels, Artemis Records, which was an indie label that I created and ran in the early aughts, put out a recording of kind of highlights from Al's initial Air America radio show, which he used to call the O. Franken Factor,
right.
Kind of, which was a goof on
O'Reilly.
Bill O'Reilly's show, the O'Reilly Factor. Later, he changed it to the Al Franken Show. The joke got a little old, but Al Franken's talent did not get old. He was incredibly good as a broadcaster. He's also, I think, great as a U.S. senator.
Absolutely. And he has a new book out. I'm going to try to get him on the air. I know it's going to be tough.
Yeah, I know. I think it comes out like the same day mine does. I'm a little jealous, but I bet it's great. I like all of his books.
Yeah, same here.
He first really emerged as a political force through his book, Rush Limbaugh is a Big Fat Idiot, which really took him from being a Saturday Night Live writer to being really someone who was a thought leader about politics.
Yeah.
He tuned into the effect of what we today call fake news and manipulating, a mass public that was not as necessarily as educated, and the pernicious effect it could have on American politics. He really was a visionary about that stuff.
And, right, liars and the lying lies and blah, blah, is right on the
and
nose.
And then the follow-up, liars and the lying lies that they tell, which was more about O'Reilly. I mean, those are two extremely, even though they have a lot of humor in them, they're, I think, very serious political books that in their own way anticipated some of the
yeah.
cultural clashes that we have today. So, you know, at a certain point, Franken asked me if I would consider, they were looking for a CEO. He felt that they didn't have a professional, the right person doing that, and they did a search, and Artemis was just sort of coming to an end, because it was affected by some of the financial trends that we were talking
right.
about in the record business. And I grabbed at it because I just thought it was such a exciting opportunity. Unfortunately, it was underfunded. The people that were supposed to fund it didn't, and it went bank. You know, I only spent about 11 months there, but it was still a privilege to work with Al and
Rachel.
It was during my brief period that we got Rachel Maddow to do the morning drive time show. She had been on it 5 a.m. before that, and then she had also earlier been one of three people doing a show, so I played she was going to be a force of nature one way or the other, but I'm glad I was able to be of help to developing her career in that brief passage in the road. On the negative side, to create room for Rachel on the drive time mornings, I was canceled Mark Maron's morning show, which I don't think he's ever forgiven me. But he certainly found a much more productive outlet for himself in his podcast. And I thought it was a good idea, and I wish that the rich people who support NGOs and other things had believed more in the idea of supporting mass media, because I think that the price we pay as a society for not communicating with people who listen to AM radio, with people that may be less educated, may not care about the New York Times, but still vote, the price we pay for not talking to them at all is very clear with the election of Donald Trump. You know, there's two Americas, it seems like.
Yeah.
And Air America was an attempt at speaking to both. And I think it was a noble attempt, but it was flawed tremendously because it was underfunded. And
right.
There were a lot of very damaged people involved in the infrastructure that was created. But I very grateful I got to spend some time with Frank and some of the others. And I wish there was something like that now.
We don't talk enough
to those people, and therefore they only hear lies.
Right. Right. So let me say two things. One, for folks who don't know, there was an initial investor that said he had the cash to get this thing started and fund it so that they would have time to really incubate and grow. And it turned out he did not have the money he said he had. And that
were a series of artists. That was only the first of you.
Okay.
I think there was this idea of if you build it, they will come, and that's fine if it's in a movie with Kevin Costner. But the fact is, if you build it, you better have enough money to build a roof, you know.
Yeah.
And they didn't. But, you know, anyway, it was a privilege to do it. It was a short period of time before it went under. The week I was there, 1 week, and I was told that it was insolvent and couldn't meet its payroll. So I literally didn't have a single week of not worrying about the funding after being told that not to worry about it. But on the other hand, I got to work with some very committed people. A lot of people involved with Air America play important roles in the media and society today. And I still think it was a good idea, but very, very badly done.
Any insights from believe, God, could we use something, as you say, that speaks to the people who don't necessarily read the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Nation? Any lessons from your time at Air America, besides the fact it's good to have the money in the bank that you say you have, about that would be that, or has the scene changed? I mean, it seems to me where those people now, they will hear podcasts, but it's just not the same.
Well, first of all, there's so many different groups in the society at various levels of technological plugins. There are still 25 million people or more who listened to AM radio. And they're overwhelmingly listened to people like Sean Hannity and Mark Levin and Michael Savage and other people that are all on the extreme right. Some of them don't even have FM radios or don't think of listening to it. They're just sort of into the aesthetic of talk radio, and it's an older audience, but they vote, and they're part of the ecosystem. But I think that the main lesson is, if you talk to people, some of them are going to hear you. I often hear people saying, these people are so prejudiced, they're so irredeemable, they're so angry, they're so filled with hate, there's no point in talking to them. I hear that a lot in Democratic circles, and that's crazy. If Martin Luther King had believed that, I mean, there never would have been a civil rights movement. I mean, the country changed and became less racist. If the gay rights movement had believed that, there still wouldn't be gay marriages. So I think that you have to, if you care about politics and issues in the country, you've got to find ways of communicating with people that are not so easy in your national, in your natural sort of social or cultural circles. And I think that the left and the Democrats have been kind of in a mindset of talking within their bubble. I think a lot of the thinking still emanates from the early 90s and the way that Bill Clinton was able to become president, which was kind of finding these, people in the middle, and, and the Reagan Democrats to vote Democratic. And I think there's been a tremendous mistake. They only campaign in certain congressional districts.
Right.
They don't go 50 states like Howard Dean wanted them to do and like Bernie Sanders wants them to do. And I think that the lesson of Air America to me was, you give them an alternative, some of them are going to want it. Al Franken never became as big as Rush Limbaugh, but he was half as big, and that was a huge deal. There were millions of people that were hearing points of view on AM radio that before and after Al Franken didn't hear it. And some of them changed their minds, and it had an effect. And, Air America's peak was 2006, which was the year that the Democrats won back the House of Representatives. I certainly don't feel it was because of Air America. There were all these other forces, particularly the negative reaction to the Iraq war, but it was part of it.
It was
definitely part of it. And so I think that the main lesson is, if you talk to people, you got a chance of getting some of them. I think Obama was into this. Matt Taibbi just wrote a very good piece about this, Rolling Stone political writer, where Obama would go into conservative districts and he would say, well, maybe I would have lost by 50 points before, and now I only would lose that district by 20 points. And that kind of willingness to reach out to everybody ended up being part of how Obama won, and not reaching out to everybody and only focusing everything kind of on negative campaigns.
Oh.
And consultants who exaggerate their own technological wisdom and throw around words like data as if it's, on tablets that came from God,
right,
has been part of the problem.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I'm gonna, before we get to the book, I'm gonna ask you about one other thing. I know that you were, if you will, behind the scenes, or at least supportive of the Occupy movement. What are your lessons from that one?
Well, the Occupy movement was certainly open to anybody to go down there, and I wouldn't say I was behind the scenes. I don't know. It was what it was. But I was living in Lower Manhattan. I was very excited by the energy and the way it just exploded around the country, and the brilliance of some of the memes, like the 99%.
Oh, absolutely.
And the sense of access and empowerment that it gave to a lot of people that weren't necessarily able to join the existing liberal organizations or political parties. Maybe they didn't have the right college degree, or maybe they didn't know the right people. And the fact that it brought a lot of people into the conversation was just incredibly exciting. And I think that the problem with it was that there was a sort of an anarchist influence on it that was very, very intimidating to a lot of people there, and that was really committed to the idea of no demands, no leadership. To me, no leadership means no accountability. You know, if you have a leader, you can get rid of a leader, but if the leaders are shadowy or behind the scenes, and I think that the idea of completely rejecting the idea of getting involved with elections or changing laws or any of the things in the existing system was, crazy and self-destructive.
Yeah.
So, I'm not an anarchist. I'm a socialist, you know. Socialist, I'm a pacifist, I'm a socialist, democratic socialist, but, you know, still one. And I don't think, to me, anarchism means that the gangsters run everything. You take away all of the rules and then it's just a thugocracy. So I think that was there were some misguided energies that helped it self-destruct very, very early. Obviously, there were external forces that wanted to hurt it. The police forces were taking orders from financial sectors and other politicians that didn't like the egalitarian message. And but that's always going to be the case. The external enemies sometimes are easier to deal with than the internal ones.
Exactly. It's interesting, by the way, when I read your talk about the first be-in in 1967, there's a line in there where someone asks, so what are our demands? And the other one says, well, we don't have any demands. This is a be-in. And I suddenly thought of Occupy.
Well, you know, it's a funny. In that situation, I mean, I quote that line favorably.
Exactly. No, I agree.
Part of a kind of a spiritual movement.
Right.
A psychedelic movement that was trying to get people to look within. It wasn't. And then there were other events that were to protest the war.
Absolutely. No, I mean, I was merely saying
for civil rights. So,
that
it wasn't one at the expense of the other.
Right.
It's just knowing which is which.
Yeah. And then here we are. Then we go 45 years later, and no demands is a lot more dangerous in the Occupy sense.
Well, I think it depends. It's because it was in a political context.
Yeah, exactly.
If people were at an ashram meditating.
Yeah.
You wouldn't say, what are your demands? But, you know, if you're criticizing Wall Street and the fact that there's an unfair allocation of resources in the society and you don't have any solutions to it, that to me is not really very productive.
Exactly. So this is a world that just might work. I'm Terrence McNally, and I'm speaking with Danny Goldberg. His latest book, which we're about to begin to talk about for the rest of the hour, is In Search of the Lost Chord, 1967 and the Hippie Idea. You can learn more about Danny and that book at DannyGoldberg.com. Okay, why did you write this book? You'd written a book about politics, the book about teen spirit. You'd written a book about the music business. What led you to write this one?
I've always had this sense that the 60s, that the official kind of the history of the 60s, sort of such as it is, the way it shows up, whether it's in CNN documentaries or some of the books, didn't really reflect in its fully the observations and experiences that I had. And somebody, a literary agent, it's my literary agent, Laura Nolan, and I and our significant others were having dinner, and she was saying, gee, 1968 is coming up, and probably you could sell a book about 50 years anniversaries of those things. And I just had this visceral panic. I said, what about 1967? Because the difference between 68 and 67 is 68 is best known for violence, you know, the assassinations of Dr. King and Robert Kennedy, the violent disturbances outside the Democratic Convention. And to me, the essence of the idealism that to me was the most memorable and inspiring about the 60s was the peak of that was the year before. So I just sort of went into kind of a trance and researched and read everything I could. There's a lot to read. There's a lot of film footage from the period. And I called the people that are still alive that I could get on the phone who were thought leaders and of that time, as well as some people I went to high school with, because 67 happens to be the year I graduated from high school, and I thought it would be interesting to get a few other perspectives on it. And I just wanted to sort of recapture for people. I mean, my the people are dying off, we're getting older, and I, like I said, I thought there was room for kind of the kind of history that I remembered, which was this combination of spirituality, psychedelics, and protest, that they were intermingled and balanced in a way that is, you know, what I call the lost chord. And I felt by the end of 67, it frayed. You know, the be-in that you referred to in January of 67 was called the Gathering of the Tribes. And I think a year later, the tribes
fractured,
broken apart,
yeah,
and fractured. But so there was that. There was a moment, you know, where it was Martin Luther King's last full year on Earth. To me, he's the greatest American of my lifetime. It was the year that LSD was illegal in most of the country, and suddenly, therefore, exploded in its availability. Prohibition always has that effect. It was the year, as we were talking earlier, that rock and roll really became this major art form, because the album was the main medium and there was a way of exposing it. Part of it was technology. There were stereos were suddenly cheaper, and every kid in a dorm room could have one of these, you know, kind of KLH stereos.
Yeah.
With like a little suitcase.
Yeah.
And suddenly there were headphones. And it was a very important, year in the African-American community. It was... in addition to it being Dr. King's last year of life, it was,
and the year in which he opposed Vietnam.
It was the year that we opposed Vietnam. It was also the year that Muhammad Ali,
right,
was convicted of avoiding the draft in Vietnam. It was also the year that Stokely Carmichael, who had become the leader of SNCC, which stood for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and Stokely Carmichael took over SNCC. John Lewis, today still a great congressman from Georgia in the U.S., was the last sort of nonviolent leader of SNCC, and Stokely Carmichael became charismatic, extremely handsome, brilliant, angry radical, coined and popularized the phrase Black Power. It was the year that the Black Panthers burst onto the scene. At the end of the year, Huey Newton is arrested for murder of a Oakland police officer, and Free Huey becomes a meme all over the world. It was the year that the Israelis won the Six-Day War, forever changing the Middle East, the ramifications which we still deal with today, and it also divided the American Jewish community.
Mm-hmm.
It was the year that Che Guevara was killed, and it was the year of some very important things in the anti-war movement, most notably the protest in October, the so-called exorcism of the Pentagon that became the basis of Norman Mailer's book Armies of the Night, kind of the last time sort of the psychedelic and radical people were working really together.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I just thought it was interesting to look at a year, how much happened there, what the clashes were, what the inspirational aspects were, how they combined, and to, in the process, although I write about it as history, I don't write about today in the book, but I do believe that there's an enormous amount that happened that year that echoes today. You know, some of the same arguments are taking place 50 years later.
Let me ask you a couple of questions, because as I said, I'm nearly your contemporary, couple of years older. I will say, by the way, that when Stokely Carmichael visited Harvard that year, I was the person who was the intermediary, escorted him up onto the stage, et cetera, you know. It was this year is a very big deal for me as well.
What was he like?
Oh, he was, as you say, he was charismatic. He was very clear. Do you know what I mean? I'm trying to say his carriage, his whole approach was like confident, authoritative, clear. He was not particularly, whatever the negative aggressive is, you know. He was strong and confident, knew where he wanted to be, knew what he wanted to say. You know, that was, he was someone to be, and at that point, of course, he was only 3 or 4 years older than I was.
Yeah, he was 25 years old.
Right, and I was probably 20, you know,
yeah.
19. But he seemed, you know, he had this gravitas about him.
Yeah.
Yeah. But when you were writing this book, did you think about, I mean, how did you, what it doesn't have, as you pointed out, is it doesn't talk a lot about today. It lays out the history, and occasionally you reflect back, and you sort of, but you, now, was that a decision you made when you started? Was that, were there moments when you said, I'd like to shift it more into a reflection where I'm bringing, you get where I'm talking about? What was that like in your writing process?
Well, you know, I wanted to document the year, and I didn't want to be anal about it, because it was a vibe that I was really trying to document, a feeling. That's why I use this metaphor of the lost chord, and I felt 1967 was the year it peaked. And I have a chapter about what led up to it, and I have a chapter about what came after it, because some of these energies were not just limited to the calendar year, but there's no question that that was the year in which they peaked, and I wanted to capture that time. I feel the word hippie and the counterculture and all these things have been really tarnished by different people's agendas. Certainly there was a right-wing agenda to discredit all of it. I also think that there was a cartoon versions of it that were very different from what I experienced. So I can understand why people of the younger generation, say the people that identified with punk or later, were not so impressed with the 60s, because they were reacting to the cartoons, not to the reality of it. And that was what the book wanted to do. You can't do everything in a book.
Right.
Once the book is done, you know, I do, in terms of trying to contextualize that time in our time, I've been writing, you know, it's a couple of pieces for The Nation.
Right.
And in talking about some of the lessons and connections. But, you know, the book is about 1967. That's what that book is about. There's a zillion books, and other people,
yeah,
you know, will write the books that they write. But to me, it was enough of a challenge to try to, really do justice to an extremely complicated period in American history where a lot of things were happening all at once, and a lot of the people documenting them either had political agendas and so were distorting things, were self-promoters, or were extremely stoned. So,
yes.
So, you know, there was a quote I found in a magazine, maybe you remember it, in the San Francisco called the Oracle,
mm-hmm.
San Francisco Oracle, that only published for about 18 months, from about the end of 66 through the beginning of 68. And it was the best document of the Haight-Ashbury aspect of the counterculture. And it was much more about mysticism and psychedelics with maybe 25% politics, whereas most of the underground press,
right,
was
the Berkeley Barb across the bay was much more political.
Yeah, it was all politics.
Yeah.
And the Los Angeles Free Press and
yeah.
East Village, a lot of
yeah.
them were much more political. And you know, the Oracle was really kind of a little more, balanced toward the hippie side
yeah,
of it,
yeah.
toward the mystical side of it. And so I found an old interview where Richard Alpert, who was then, who later was renamed
Ram Dass yeah.
by his guru, but who had become, was known at that time as a former Harvard professor who, along with Timothy Leary, had been fired by Harvard for giving LSD to undergraduates, and they had become, you know, pretty big deals in the hippie scene, in my opinion, justifiably so. And so some kid asked him, gee, do you think we need an actual physical revolution in the country? There was a lot of loose talk about revolution as if that was physically possible to
mm-hmm,
do.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a big fan of people who delude themselves into thinking you can create violent revolution in this country, because the result of that is almost inevitably counterproductive and a lot of suffering. But nonetheless, people were asked the question all the time in the context of the frustration about Vietnam and the divisions in the society. So they said, you know, do you think we'll have a revolution? We need a revolution. And he said, oh, no, I think within 8 years we'll have a psychedelic majority in America and we can have a completely different kind of government. So in doing the book, I interviewed him and I said, well,
yeah.
I read this quote where you said in 8 years, what do you make of that now? So he says, well, two things. First of all, he says, always a bit bad idea to make predictions while you're tripping.
Yep.
And he said, secondly, I think I got the time frame wrong, but I still believe that the country is going to change and that people are, that there's going to be a shift where the inner, you know, consciousness is given as much weight, you know, dominant weight, and that there will be that transformation in consciousness. So, you know, there was a lot going on, and I just tried to capture it. That's all I can say, you know. And it's no one can capture it correctly because no two people experienced it the same. I don't think there's one truth about it, but at least I could give my truth about it.
Right, and you very clearly state this is a subjective history. At one point you even say, to visit the places and conversations I was not cool enough to have been a part of at the
Correct.
Time. And let me just
Correct.
Tell you a quick anecdote about Ram Dass and Leary. My first week at Harvard, 1965, fall of 1965, I have a flat top. I have Madras shirts. Do you know what I mean?
And I
see a sign on a tree that says Leary and Alpert will be speaking that week. And I go, and it was like walking into the 60s. You know, they're surrounded by their grad students and their acolytes, and I am this kid from Cocoa, Florida. 4 years later, 1969, in the spring of 69, while the university is on strike against ROTC and for a black studies department, Richard Alpert returns to Harvard and as Ram Dass, and in one of his first public appearances in his return to the U.S., takes about 4 hours in a packed lecture hall to tell the story that becomes the book, Be Here Now. I mean, so it bookended my college experience.
Well, you know, I dedicate my book to Ram Dass, Wavy Gravy, and Paul Krasner. And, I do think that Ram Dass has had a unique contribution for the good. But meanwhile, it's a big world, big country, and as we were saying before, talking about talk radio, somehow the counterculture, the people I admired, the political leaders I admire, just didn't reach out to enough of the country.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and this idea of counterculture, it's a word I always had a lot of affection for, but now I look at it and I see, well, then it's against something.
Yeah.
And people don't really like being condescended to, looked down on, and excluded.
Yeah.
That's not a very effective way of creating harmony. And, you know, when I was a kid, we used to divide everybody up into straights and heads.
Yeah.
The straights were the people who didn't get high, and the heads were the people who did. And I really was into that distinction. I wanted to be friends with heads, and I kind of looked down on people who were straight, like they just didn't get it.
Yeah.
But you know what? I don't think people like being looked down on.
The other thing,
I know I don't.
Absolutely.
And I think collectively, in our desire to, protest the war in Vietnam, which was just, to me, a complete mistake, and the fact that anyone is still alive who defends it blows my mind. And we also had these, censorship still in the arts. Lenny Bruce died in 66 because of tormented by prosecutors because he would say the word and comedy routines, and of course he became the dominant influence on the next 500 big comedians. But and you had sexual repression, and of course the counterculture initially was not so good about accepting the humanity of gays and women either, but it caught up as people organized around it. And but I think that there was a that somehow the polarization that may have come for good reasons, because there were dark things to be against, racism and war and unfairness. The polarization just still reverberates in a way to today's polarization.
Oh, absolutely.
And we just can't have that. You know, we have to find a way of reaching out more. And my hero from the period remains Dr. King, because he was unrelenting and fearless in terms of standing up where he thought it was right. against the war, against racism, and against a lot of the most pernicious aspects of capitalism.
Absolutely.
He was very radical politically, much more than you'd know by listening to some of these holiday celebrations. But he believed in love. He believed in nonviolence. He believed in reaching out. And that's the person I think we miss the most.
Right. Now, it's interesting how he you talk about the counterculture being a cartoon image, you know, coming forward. It's not a cartoon image, but is a very sanitized image of Dr. King that comes forward. And in having been there, we know that in both those cases, the reality was very different. You know what I'm saying about him.
I think there's been some good work on this. I think Michael Eric Dyson wrote a very good book about this. I mean, I do think there's been a lot of people who carry the torch of what he really was all about. But we still don't have him.
Yeah,
and, you know, one of the, you know, leaders do matter.
Yes. No, by the way, I think that it's a point that I make that I think people overlook way too much when they talk about the way the right outplayed the left or the way, you know, that is that if you assassinate John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, and John Lennon, you've taken away five once-in-a-lifetime charismatic leaders. And that's that. There, when you look at who gets elected, for instance, who gets elected president, I looked at it since 1960. To my mind, unless there were two non-charismatic candidates, like Carter Ford, the more charismatic always wins, and five of our most charismatic leaders were knocked off.
Correct. Well, we soldier on.
Yes.
And, you know, it's... There was a certain naivete in the 60s about the idea that we could just sort of fix the whole world very quickly. And part of it was the example of Dr. King.
Yes.
Because the civil rights movement, after sort of 100 years of African-Americans struggling to get any rights at all post-Civil War, in that period between the Montgomery bus boycott and the mid-60s, you know, the Civil Rights Bill passes, Voting Rights Bill passes, and there's real changes in some parts of society. I mean, obviously, it wasn't all fixed. We still have great racial tension today, but there was dramatic progress made during that decade. And I think there was this feeling that that's the way life was always going to be. And the reality is that everything Dr. King did, as unique and inspiring as he was on the shoulders of, you know, 100 years of other people's work.
Yep.
And that we're probably not going to fix the entire world in our lifetime. And the challenge of this kind of work is to try to do the best you can. It's like that Jewish saying, you know, you heal the part of the world that you can heal, but don't expect, you know, to fix the whole world. You know, that's God's job.
Yeah.
And I think that there's a... certain childish impatience about expecting, okay, we didn't fix everything, therefore we failed, as opposed to, you know, how do we make things a little bit better? I mean, if a doctor took that point of view, they would never treat anybody because all their patients eventually are going to die.
Right.
But
you know, I spoke with a young person, 26 years old, who's an activist, and I said to him that I felt we had failed in the 60s, and he said, no, I don't think you failed. You were 50 years ahead of your time. Which, in some sense,
I don't know, you know,
but it has that long-term perspective you're talking about.
Yeah, I think if look, you know, there were things that succeeded, there are things that failed. I do think there's been a lot of progress in race relations and in the empowerment of women and
gender,
and gays,
yep,
and free speech,
yep,
and in some other issues. I think culturally, there's a more diverse culture today. With you go almost anywhere in the country, you'll find a vegetarian place,
mm-hmm,
a yoga place, alternative medicine. But in terms of the basic, more ancient demons of humanity, such as greed and violence, you know, guess what? It wasn't all fixed in one or two generations. But it's still worth carrying on, because I think there's some, you know, better feeling you get by doing the best you can.
I have been thinking about the 60s a lot, starting about 3 or 4 years ago, as I looked at young people, millennials, and noticed that they shared a lot of the same values of we did in the 60s, community, civil and human rights, questioning consumption, questioning competition, the environment, organic agriculture, spiritual, but not religious, a belief that change might be possible. And then it occurred to me, and I'm going to set this up and then I want your response, that there are a few things that might improve their chances of moving even further and maybe making change more sustainable. One is the technology that makes it easier to reduce material consumption nowadays, you know, and to interact with diverse others unbound by geography. Second, the greater inclusivity of women and minorities in, you know, you have more voices, you have more intelligence. And third, the millions of our generation and the generations in between that might welcome and support them, whereas in the 60s, there were, you know, a few beatniks in Greenwich Village, as you point out, and a few in the Bay Area. But other than that, this was a new consciousness, whereas I think they can see that there's people they could align with. What are your thoughts about that vision, that image?
Well, I have two millennial kids, a boy and a girl, and they both are very inspiring to me. And I think that more likely is they'll tell us than we being able to tell them, you know, where energy goes. I do think that's the usually younger people have a better notion about these things. I think you make some really, really good points about certain advantages in the playing field that they have that we didn't have. There are some disadvantages. It's a much worse middle-class economy. So, the you know, when I needed to get a job after dropping out of college, I opened up the New York Times, circled five ads, and got two of the jobs, you know, and picked one. That's not so easy to do today.
And when I graduated from college, I had $3,000 in debt, not 30.
Yeah, or 300.
Yeah.
Right. So I think that they're to the extent we talk about the United States, I think they're growing up in a poorer country, and a country with certainly in terms of the educational system, much higher price you pay for a college degree. The reality of global warming is there, and it's different than what we had to think about, although we were thinking about a military draft.
And nuclear war. We thought about nuclear war.
Assassination. So I think there were some pretty bad times. We've had some FBI directors lately that have been problematic, but nobody as bad as J. Edgar Hoover.
Right.
So I think it really I think that young people, though, are the future and the hope. I think the fact that they voted so overwhelmingly for Bernie Sanders is an extremely vivid signal of where their politics are. And, you know, I'm looking forward to seeing the leaders and ideas they produce. I hope that they learn some of the lessons, such as nonviolence. You know, violence just does not work. There's no evidence. There's no evidence that I've seen of violence working in this society to make things better. I think that the free speech is important. I think this idea of physically preventing people from speaking is a bad idea.
Yep.
And that it may be temporarily satisfying, but it sets a standard and a norm which will do much more harm to progressives than it will be to the right wing. And I think there has to be some way of finding mutuality between people that are committed to making the system work and those who criticize the dark parts of the system. You can't only think about elections and you can't ignore elections. You can't only think about policies that help feed people today, but you can't ignore that. And I hope to just give a simplistic view that the sort of the Bernie types, the Occupy types, and the Hillary types can find common ground. They're different culturally. They're going to differ on some issues, but this is a moment of crisis where I think there has to be some coalitions to really try to overcome the darkest forces. We didn't create those coalitions in the 60s. That's something they should not replicate.
Absolutely. Okay, the website is DannyGoldberg.com. The book is In Search of the Lost Chord, 1967, and the Hippie Idea. Thank you, Danny Goldberg. Keep up the good work.
Thank you so much, Terrence. God bless.
Yeah. For this conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts of interviews, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMcNally, one word, .net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. www.thebookofmormon.com. They're both the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, sign up at my site or email me at TEMCNALLY@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the podcast on iTunes. You can find years of podcasts at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, or at iTunes. Listen anytime, anywhere. The archives include Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle. Thanks to G, my engineer, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all to you, my listeners. Please share this podcast widely.